Support for TPR comes from Texas Mutual Insurance Company, a workers' comp provider committed to helping employers get their people home safely. Preventing workplace accidents protects families and keeps businesses productive. More at texasmutual.com.
From Texas Public Radio, this is Texas Matters, a weekly radio news magazine that looks at the issues, events, and people in the Lone Star State. Today on Texas Matters, some scary hours with the Texas grid during the summer heat. What happened? And Republican candidates for president say they'll invade Mexico. Why that is a terrible idea.
It would be devastating, not only for Mexico, but for the United States.
This is Texas Matters from Texas Public Radio. I'm David Martin Davies. On Thursday night, Texas had an electric grid emergency. Messages were sent out across the state asking folks to reduce their power consumption in order to avoid rolling blackouts. This was while triple-digit heat was baking much of the state. The tight energy conditions are expected to continue for at least several more days. Well, why is this happening? How can it be avoided? And how much will it cost us? To get answers, I reached out to Doug Lewin. He is the author of the Texas Energy and Power Newsletter, president of Stoic Energy, and the host of the Texas Power Podcast.
There's very tight conditions on the grid when we see this kind of elevated heat. So as you and I have talked about before, David, there's sort of three things you look at for getting into these situations, whether it be a conservation call and or potential rolling outages. And those are really high demand, high thermal outages, low wind and solar output. And usually when you get those three things combined is really where you have the problems. We've had really, really high demand. And I think people are getting a little bit numb to it, that there are these peaks of 83, 84,000 megawatts every day. And to put that in perspective, our summertime high through 2021, including the summer of 2021, was about 75,000. So to be just day after day above 80,000, above even 82 or 83,000 is pretty extraordinary. And even as the sun is going down, that demand is staying up somewhere in that 80,000 kind of range. So that is, again, to see well after the peak, a sustained demand at that level is pretty extraordinary. The same heat that's driving that demand high is putting a tremendous strain on thermal plants. And then wind and solar, we're seeing levels of wind that are lower than typical, but higher than what ERCOT actually defines as low wind. In fact, yesterday, about double what they define as low wind. And solar is making a very big difference earlier in the day, right? That we're not having, they're making these conservation calls for 3 to 10, which I don't understand. It really should be like 7 to 9, because we're really not having that many problems at 3, 4, or 5 in the afternoon. And that's because of the contribution of solar. So you put all those things together and you end up just with very tight conditions. And it looks like we'll have it again tonight.
We are looking at these graphs that have been online about the demand and the ability to produce. And then there's like a little purple area that shows where demand is outpacing the ability to produce. So what's the significance of that?
Yeah, obviously you don't want those lines to cross, right? If those lines cross are actually, so what those lines don't show is there are some other tools in the toolbox that ERCOT does have at its disposal, things like emergency response service, these generators and loads. It's a form of demand response as well that can drop off. There are certain things they've got that don't show up there that they would deploy before we would get into rolling outages. But obviously, the closer that those lines get, the likelier it is that there would be rolling outages. I do, if folks are looking at the dashboard and trying to follow along, I encourage them to look at the box right next to there and to click on that little button that says daily PRC. When that PRC, that's the reserves, when those drop below 3,000 or even down below 2,500, that's really when things are quite critical. The graph with the blue and the purple can be a little misleading because there's other things they have. That PRC really shows it. Just one other thing on this, David, storage is really coming in big right now. We saw that last night, a sustained period of 90 minutes where we had storage above 600 megawatts. It peaked briefly over 1,000 megawatts. We're going to see those levels double or even triple by next summer. and storage is really quite helpful during those periods. We also need to get more serious about demand response, because where you see that blue and that purple get really tight, there is the ability to reduce energy use and pay customers for doing it. That's a tool, particularly for residential demand response, that ERCOT just doesn't have. It's a lever that in other markets and other places in the country, they're able to pull that lever. We just really don't have it here. And that's sort of, I think, the next frontier in grid reliability.
When you say storage, do you mean like battery facilities?
That's right. Yeah, they're almost all lithium ion battery packs at this point. We'll see different chemistries and technologies come into the market in future years. But right now it's battery packs. They're just perfectly suited to that time as the sun is going down and demand is still relatively high. And so it's making a difference right now. But again, that we're going to see that difference multiplied many times next year and even more the year after.
And when you talk about thermal plants, those are generators that burn coal or natural gas, things that aren't renewables. Is that it?
That's right. Gas, coal, and nuclear are thermal plants. Technically, geothermal plants could also be thermal, but we don't have geothermal power plants yet. Hopefully we will soon. And nuclear, we haven't seen any outages. Knock on wood, we haven't seen any outages in nuclear since June. So when we talk about thermal outages, we're really talking about gas and coal.
So did they fix the grid or are we experiencing a non-fixed grid?
Yeah, I mean, you know, I think sometimes that phrase is a little, this is going to be an ongoing process, right? I mean, there's challenges to the grid. There's you know, growing demand. There's variable resources. There's an aging thermal fleet, those gas and coal plants that are breaking down. There's all of these challenges kind of happening at once. And so I'm not sure there'll ever be a point, David, where we could just say, yep, the grid is fixed. I will say, to the extent that we have tools like more battery energy storage, like demand response, like this, you know, these tools that grid operators can use, I think if we have those, we will see far less conservation calls, far less of these really tight windows where, you know, the ERCOT control room is white knuckling it through there, right? So, but even then, I wouldn't say, hey, if we get more storage and more demand response, mission accomplished, it's all over, right? Like there's always going to be iterations and improvements, evolution of technology and different challenges, some of which we can't even anticipate right now. So it's always going to be a work in progress. Hopefully a work in progress with less drama as we get more of these tools like storage and demand response.
So we got messaging like on our smartphones, like an Amber Alert type of a thing, asking us to conserve. Our local power utility also put out messaging emails saying, please conserve. Is the messaging good right now as far as communicating with the public? Is there still some reluctance to put out this call? Because it seemed like it first came from the local utility and then finally it came from, I think, eventually ERCOT. I wasn't really sure who sent out that other message. But I got the sense before that there was a political, I don't know what you want to call it. Some people in office in Texas didn't like the fact that ERCOT was putting out these messages and they asked them not to do it. Is that happening?
Yeah, I don't know the extent to which, there's been political pressure on them to not do it. I can't really speak to that. I don't know. I will say that obviously, neither ERCOT nor really anybody like wants to do these kinds of conservation. I don't, you know, alerts. I don't think it's a pleasant experience for any politician or ERCOT or anything like that. To your question of, are the communications good? Are they effective? I've said many times, and I'll continue to say it, I do not think that giving a conservation call that lasts 7 hours is particularly useful. The tight window does not last 7 hours. And I think it's very hard for people who want to help to actually reduce their use for 7 straight hours. And really, when you were referring to those blue and purple lines on the dashboard, the really difficult time is 2 hours. And really, you could even get more near. I mean, it's really, if you look at that, it's right at like 8 o'clock and 30 minutes either side. So I think, a 7 to 9 window And this is, again, where kind of demand response comes in, David, is if we can get to a point where instead of begging people, instead of asking people, there's an automatic, systematic, programmatic way where people can sign up and be paid and actually pre-cool their homes, because there's so much power in the middle of the day. You look at those lines right now, there's plenty of extra power. So if you pre-cool your home, if your home is well insulated, we've got to work on energy efficiency too, but you make your house like that Yeti cooler, right? And you put something in the Yeti cooler, it stays cold all day long. A home with good insulation will stay cool through that several hour period when we have really high demand. So if we can actually get those kinds of programs in place, they won't need to make the conservation call. For now, while they need to make conservation calls, it really should be the tightest possible window so that folks can know, go ahead and make your home a little cooler at 3 or 4 or 5 in the evening and try to use a little less between 7 to 9. So that's where I think the biggest improvement could come. And also just making the calls earlier in the day so people can kind of plan for that kind of thing. I think that makes sense as well. But better than all that is to actually have a program and make it systematic and pay people for the reductions that they're making.
And if there isn't that reduction and the demand continues to be really high, we were told that there would be rolling blackouts in Texas. There were 15-minute rolling blackouts. I don't know if there ever were any on Thursday night. And if there were, would they really be 15 minutes? And how do they decide who gets blacked out and when?
Those are great questions. So let me answer the easy ones first. There have not been any rolling blackouts as of yet this summer. If, and this is really important because I was seeing some stuff flying around Twitter that, like, if there's outages, this is February 2021 again. It would not be February 2021 again. If we were to have rolling outages in the summertime, it's just like you were talking about earlier with those purple and blue lines. They would cross. They would barely cross. It obviously is not ideal. We don't want this to happen. It's a dangerous situation, but it is nothing even remotely like February 2021. They would be short duration. They would actually roll because you're only, 500 megawatts or 1,000 megawatts short. In February 2021, we were 20,000 megawatts short for days on end. Here we'd be talking about a very small fraction of that, right? Maybe 1/20th of the depth of outage, and the time wouldn't be comparable at all, right? We'd be talking about less than an hour, maybe an hour on the outer band. How they make those decisions, they apportion it according to each utility. So those instructions go to CenterPoint and Oncor and Austin Energy and CPS Energy, so on and so forth. They apportion that based on their load side, and then those utilities have to decide which circuits they're going to turn off. How they make those decisions internally, I do not know. They are required to file some reports with the commission about this, but from some legislation passed during the session, but they won't file those until sometime next year. So those would be good questions for the utilities. I don't know how they make those decisions, but again, if there's one thing I'm communicating here is people should not have a flashback to Uri here. That's not what this would be. They would be very short duration and not very deep.
So you talked about this being a dangerous situation, and I imagine that the danger is that the grid could crash. Is that it?
No. The danger would actually just be that whenever you're shutting off somebody's power, okay, there's the potential you're shutting off somebody that's got medical equipment in their home. There is a process, by the way, and it's important for listeners. Like, if you do have medical equipment in your home and your life is dependent upon that equipment working, you can fill out a form with your utility, and there is some special sort of circumstance for that. But that's what I mean by it. It's dangerous because, if you've got somebody that's has certain health risks, right? Elderly population, that kind of thing. Being without power, even for a short period of time, can be somewhat dangerous. Particularly, again, if somebody was maybe they were heeding that conservation call and they put their house up to 80 degrees, and then their power goes out, and now it's into the mid 80s inside their home. Those kinds of things can be dangerous. That's what I mean by that. The grid would not collapse because that is why they do rolling outages, because they have to make sure that the grid does not entirely go down. That was a concern during Uri because the outages were so deep and widespread that we got a little closer than comfort, although not super close, to having the whole grid go down and being in a black start situation where they got to bring it back up. Nothing, again, nothing like that in the summertime. And that is why they would do outages, because we would never, the grid operator would never allow it to get anywhere close to that kind of situation. So thank you for asking the question, because I think, look, there's a reasonable sort of, anxiety around this stuff. And then there's an unreasonable anxiety. And I don't want anybody to think this is anywhere close to the, is why I continue to say, I think wintertime is a much bigger problem. Summer is difficult and it's a challenge, but the solutions like battery storage and demand response and those kinds of things are right there for us to use. Winter is a much harder problem, because you do end up with these much longer sustained periods of potential deficit of supply compared to demand.
Well, we do seem, though, have this single point failure possibility of our, if the grid or something were to happen to it, we'd be in a lot of trouble. It really brings home the fact how vulnerable we are to some sort of action that would take down our grid, whether through, these demand circumstances or through malfeasance and a bad actor trying to do something to us. How well are protected are we from something like that?
That's a great question. I think it's really important that we start to think about, these discussions are happening more and more, right? Like what does resiliency actually mean? And how is that different than reliability? In the past, we've always defined reliability as, do you have enough supply to exceed demand by some percent? Somebody decided it might be 13% or 15%. Somebody didn't study somewhere and decided that's what it should be. And that's sort of typically defined as reliability. Do you have enough that you would only have one outage every 10 years or something? But resiliency, which we're starting to think about more and more, and in the power industry, you hear these discussions like all the time now, is how do you have more distributed resources? So what you're talking about, like single point of failure, right? If you've got really large power plants, and if you've got really large power plants that are all dependent upon gas, and in the wintertime, gas supply freezes, right? You have this sort of single point of failure in your system. Is there a way to get more distributed resources on the grid, solar and storage, and even thinking of energy efficiency as a resiliency strategy? Because again, your home is wrapped in that insulation, it's going to stay much warmer in the winter and much cooler in the summer than if it didn't have it. So, and the Public Utility Commission happily just yesterday announced that they had, for the first time, they've got a pilot of what they call virtual power plants. And what they mean by virtual power plant is lots of small sources that add up to enough that it actually could equal a big power plant. So things like solar and storage, particularly storage in this phase of their virtual power plants, the more we get those out there and they're distributed throughout the system at homes and businesses, offices, community centers, municipal buildings, the more you have those out there and they have the ability to island, they have the ability that if the grid goes down, they can keep whoever is inside that building with AC, with power on inside. That's a key resiliency strategy as well. And oh, by the way, David, it helps with that broader reliability piece too, because those are real resources that help you with the reliability question. Do I have enough supply to meet demand? And they increase your resiliency to things like whether it's a cybersecurity attack, whether it's a hurricane, whether it's a winter storm, all those distributed resources, a more distributed grid, decentralized kind of grid, makes us much stronger and more resilient to all sorts of different circumstances.
So resilience, reliability, that's important, but so is affordability. What's this doing to our cost for power?
Yeah. Thanks for the question. It's an important one. I mean, look, I talk about this a lot. I think that the affordability crisis deserves to be on equal footing with the reliability crisis. And what I mean by that is, the U.S. Census does ask people regularly, have you had to choose between food, medicine, rent, and your utilities? And in Texas, within the last year, that number has been around 40% of Texans self-report having to choose between these things. There's a couple of factors that have driven our rates lower. The price of natural gas has been much lower this year. That is still the dominant fuel on the ERCOT system. It was three times as much last year, so that pushed rates very high. Renewables have helped to have a price suppressive effect. There was one study that Josh Rhodes at IdeaSmiths and UT Energy Institute did that over the, I believe it was just in 2022, because gas prices were high, it was something along the lines of like $10 billion in savings. So that's helping to drive price rates lower. But your bill is two things. It's rates times your usage. And when it's 100, 105 every day, we're all using a lot more power than we would use in what in what used to be a normal summer. Unfortunately, this might be more like an average summer from here on out. And so we've got to start taking that into account. Bills are very high. It is extremely important that the Public Utility Commission and legislators really start to focus on this affordability crisis. I don't think there's been much focus on it at all yet. There was a petition by the AARP and the Texas Consumer Association to put a moratorium on disconnects. I think a moratorium on disconnects is good, but even better would be to actually, when somebody is going through that process of being disconnected for non-payment, that we actually reach out to them with an energy assessment. Does your home have any insulation, right? Are you using an HVAC system that is 15 or 20 years old and is maybe breaking, and that's why it's using so much power? And then target the incentives. We do have energy efficiency programs. They're among the smallest of any country, of any state in the country, rather. We could increase those and target them to those that most need them. There's significant incentives in the Inflation Reduction Act for this as well. So energy efficiency is not only a key strategy for grid reliability, it also helps with affordability and what I think is a pretty acute affordability crisis we're in. And David, we haven't really seen this yet, right? Because like the heat wave really started end of June, and really picked up in mid-July. Those bills don't settle for some days after that, and you don't get the bill till a few weeks later, and it's not due till a few weeks after that. So I think in September and October, we're going to see a lot of shutoffs. But you as a reporter and the general public won't have access to that information. The Public Utility Commission does not require utilities to report how many folks they shut off. We're one of only a few states that do that. So we really need a systematic approach to dealing with this. Lessening shutoffs, getting people energy efficiency to reduce their bills. This is going to be a really big problem for the rest of this year. And unfortunately, I think with this heat and human caused climate change, that we're just going to see this as a perennial issue, unfortunately.
Doug Lewin is the author of the Texas Energy and Power newsletter. He's the president of Stoic Energy and the host of the Texas Power podcast. This week, during the debate for the qualifying Republican candidates for president, one applause line that all of the candidates seem to agree with is the need to send American armed forces into Mexico to kill members of the drug cartels and destroy the labs that manufacture fentanyl, a deadly narcotic. San Antonio Congressman Joaquin Castro, a Democrat, says this is a terrible idea. It will not work. It'll only make matters much, much worse.
The Republicans who are talking about invading Mexico are taking our country down a very dark, dangerous road. And I don't think they've really thought this thing through besides trying to excite a political base. It would be devastating, not only for Mexico, but for the United States. And remember, there are close to 2 million Americans who live in Mexico. Mexico is one of our largest trading partners. It's an important ally when it comes to economic cooperation on migration, on interdicting drugs, on all of these things. Invading Mexico would make us as sympathetic around the world as a figure like Vladimir Putin. I mean, it would just destroy the foreign policy standing of America around the world.
Now, what these candidates are talking about, they say, well, we'll just send in the military into Mexico to find the cartels and to wipe them out. Or we will use drones to bomb cartels and wipe them out. And problem solved. And they may not be seeing it as an invasion, but that's what that would be. How do you normalize sending your military into a sovereign nation to commit an act of war? That seems to be a very explosive scenario.
Yeah, I think what you see happening is the unraveling of a political party, the Republican Party. Right now, unfortunately, Republicans don't have a real policy platform to take on the issues that Americans face every day, whether it's fixing healthcare, fixing schools, improving the economy, fighting inflation, any number of issues. And so in lieu of that, because they still want to win people over and get votes, obviously, they have to do outlandish things that generate more fear and more resentment among people. And their number one boogeyman is immigration and the border, China, Mexico, and so forth. And so this is right in the center of that. But just because it comes out of their mouth doesn't mean that they've actually thought any of this through or that it makes any kind of sound policy sense. And so when I hear them talk about those things, I don't think they've actually thought through what kind of carnage and how devastating this whole thing would be and what it means. And, you know, to some extent, I think they feel like they can say anything up there and there are no real consequences because whatever Donald Trump says, for example, there's still a solid 35% of the country or so that will latch on to whatever direction he goes, whatever new outlandish, crazy proposal he comes up with. And so that has taught people like Ron DeSantis and the others, obviously, that there's no real consequences to what kind of crazy stuff they say and put out there.
So Mexico is now the number one trading partner with the United States. It has grown past China, grown past Canada into being the top dog trading with goods back and forth across the border. It's very closely linked and integrated with American commerce and manufacturing that happens in our country. We're seeing the GDP in Mexico growing. Mexico is stabilizing because of this. I mean, there are issues there, and there are drug cartels, and there are drugs are flowing. But to destabilize Mexico would not solve any problem. It certainly would not solve an immigration problem. It would increase the immigration problem, I would think.
You destabilize Mexico by starting a war there, by invading it, by using missile strikes, whatever it is, you're going to have a lot of people fleeing Mexico and come into the United States, including, as I mentioned, up to 2 million Americans. Remember, let's just start with those people. Those are Americans who have their immediate right of return. So you're talking about a flood of people. And you also have a lot of people, Mexicans, who are going to look for a way out of that carnage. And so they're going to be trying to go somewhere.
I've read this in right-wing media and blogs. We say we can't be invading Mexico's sovereign territory, and they will reply saying, well, Mexico doesn't have control over its sovereign territory, that cartels have taken over, and so therefore it's okay if we do that then. Can you tease apart how that is not the way the world works?
Well, first, the answer is to help Mexico take on the cartels. The answer is more engagement with Mexico and helping them. I have legislation that would help cut down on drug trafficking to Mexico. Between 75 and 90% of the guns that are recovered in these murders, where you've got cartel members who are murdering people in Mexico, they're American-made guns. They're guns that came from the United States. So if you want to stop the cartels from having as much influence in Mexico, as much leverage in Mexico, do something about arms trafficking.
Joaquin Castro is a Democrat and a congressman representing San Antonio. That's it for this edition of Texas Matters. Thanks for listening. I'm David Martin Davies. You can email us at texasmatters@tpr.org. You can listen to past episodes of Texas Matters on our website at tpr.org. You can download, rate us, and subscribe to us wherever you find great podcasts. And tune in again next week for another edition of Texas Matters from Texas Public Radio.
Support for TPR comes from Texas Mutual Insurance Company, a workers' comp provider committed to helping employers get their people home safely. Preventing workplace accidents protects families and keeps businesses productive. More at texasmutual.com.